Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves.
We're at the Authors Studio at Book Expo America 2012 in New York City. And our guest right now is Harold Quawasser. He's written a book called Renewal, Remaking America's Schools for the 21st Century. Hello, Harold. How are you?
Hi. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, same here. All right. So you are proposing a new model, a new style of education. Before we get into that new model, tell me why you think the old style, the old model is not working.
We used to do mass production education in this country, which was one teacher using one textbook that was taught one way in one classroom. And the problem with that model is it didn't work for lots of kids. They had different learning styles. They had different interests. They were at different levels of mastery. They had different levels of social and emotional development. So we just lost sight of lots of kids. And for most of the 20th century, that was acceptable. But in the wake of the Civil Rights Revolution, in the wake of our growing sensitivity about special needs kids, in the wake of the decline of American manufacturers, where kids with just high school educations no longer could find good jobs, we had to do something different. We couldn't lose sight of any of our kids. So we had to find a way to educate everybody and to figure out how to educate kids who learn differently or who had different interests. We now really had to take this on. The good news is that in the last 20 years, there have actually been school districts around the country that have figured out how to do it. Although there's lots of talk about our need for innovating in the schools, it really isn't quite as true as it might have been a few years ago. There is a model out there that works. Now, that doesn't mean we don't keep innovating in the future, but there's a model. The great challenge right now isn't how to do it. The great challenge is to get the adults in the system to do it. And the point about the book is I looked around and I said, now, who can in fact drive this change? Where does it come from? And after 10 years of No Child Left Behind, what became very apparent was you couldn't outsource change to Washington. You can't outsource it to state capitals. What you have to do is you have to do it school by school and district by district. And that means that the people that those districts are accountable to, parents, community leaders, they're the ones who ultimately have to drive the change. And of course, you can say that to a parent, and the parent says, that's nice, but what am I supposed to do? And the answer is read the book, because the book tells you what it is you're supposed to do and explains what is unfortunately a very long and complicated process about how to get there. But the good news is, hey, there is a model. You can do it. There are at least 40 school districts around the country that have done it. And they haven't necessarily been rich, and they haven't necessarily been white, and they haven't necessarily had any great advantages. They demonstrate that any school district in the country can do it. But what you, Mr. and Mrs. Parent, have to do is go out and push to get it done.
Okay, what is that new model?
The new model is completely different from the old model. And that's the first major point. There's not one thing you change. There's not 10 things you change. You change everything. Let me give you a quick example. In the new model, teaching is much more challenging than it used to be, because where it used to be the one teacher, one textbook, one way of teaching, now you're trying to address the needs of a variety of kids, and you're not using the same methods. You're not necessarily using the same materials. Teaching is a lot more challenging. So suddenly, evaluating how teachers teach becomes a lot more important. In the old days, in fact, under mass production, that wasn't so important. The way it was all designed was to assume teachers really weren't all that good at what they did, and we were going to script them so that they did it exactly the way we wanted. Now, you can't script them, because they have to adapt to all sorts of challenges every minute, every day. This is a much more complicated task. So evaluating how good teachers are and pushing them to constantly improve becomes a much bigger deal than it ever was in the old days. It's just one change out of many. But if you say, well, gee, we're going to have much better evaluation and much more training, think about what that actually means. It means suddenly principals have got to understand what good teaching looks like. In the old days, they never used to. Now you've got to teach them what it looks like. In the old days, you didn't worry about individualized professional development. The central office said, okay, everybody this week is going to learn about how to teach fourth grade math. No more. Now it is, you have a problem here. You don't understand how to teach fractions or something. You may understand something else perfectly well, but you don't understand how to teach fractions. So we're going to train you about how to teach fractions. That means that all of that professional development in the school district is completely different from what it used to look like. And because you, the teacher, are making a lot of decisions out at the edge, it means we in the central office cede a lot of authority to you. And a lot of that central decision-making is now pushed out to the principal and to the teaching corps in an individual school. So the whole thing is different. It simply doesn't look anywhere near what it used to. One of the great challenges when you ask parents to push change is every parent thinks they have a PhD in education because they spent at least 12 years in it, and they think they know. They think they know what good teaching looks like. The problem is they were back in the buggy whip model, and we're now in the automobile age. So what they thought was good really bears no relationship to what good looks like now. So they've got to update their own vision to ensure that their kids get the education they deserve.
Well, you know how resistant people are to change.
Yes.
In this new model you're proposing, what is the biggest obstacle? What's the biggest challenge? What's the thing that people might have? And by people, I mean administrators, parents, teachers, children. What is the thing they will be most resistant to buy in on?
There are two things. One relates to teachers. One relates to superintendents and principals. The teachers is that they're used to teaching from one textbook and teaching one way. They've had a lesson plan for 10 years. They're comfortable with it. They like that. Now you're saying, no, it's not going to be one textbook. It's not going to be one way. And your lesson plan might last 10 minutes, but it certainly won't last 10 years. The job we're asking teachers to do is much tougher. It's much more intense. They're under a great deal more pressure. It's perfectly understandable why they don't want to change. With superintendents, in this model, you're saying you've got to trust those principals and you've got to trust those teachers because that's where many decisions are going to get made. You can't do it all from the central office. If you try to do it from the central office, you will fail. In fact, in the book, I go over the history of Miami-Dade, which made an attempt at reform in the mid-2000s and ultimately called it off, concluding that it had been a failure. And one of the problems was that although on the one hand, there were talking the talk of reform where decisions were pushed out to the schools and the teachers. In fact, they didn't really trust the principals and the teachers, and they were trying to hold in lots of the decisions in the central office. Doesn't work. So in the new world, that superintendent has to let go, and that's not easy. And in fact, the superintendent has to do something else in addition to let go. The superintendent has to agree to live with the numbers. In the old days, superintendents would spin failure. Oh, no, everything's fine. We're doing great. We're professionals. We know what we're doing, no matter how dismal the results were. In the new world, there's transparency. There are benchmarks. You know what the benchmarks are. The parents know what the benchmarks are. And some of them are student test scores, but some of them aren't. But in any event, they're benchmarks. They're out there, and you have to live with them. You can't spin your way out of trouble. So just like with the teachers, in the new world, those superintendents and principals are under a lot more pressure than they used to be, leading, of course, to the point you're making, which is that there's natural resistance to these changes. The thing that I found that was most incredible about the superintendents who had actually changed school districts is that these are folks who educated themselves about reform, who most of whom didn't start out as reformers, but they learned. They became believers, they were willing to change their own behavior, and then they were willing to lead other people to change theirs. When you think about that, and you think about the natural bias not to change, these folks were really extraordinary. And if there's one reason that it's hard to replicate change around the country, is that it's hard to come by people like this. Your point about being resistant to change is exactly right. When you look at the people who've changed things, the fact that they changed themselves first is just extraordinary. They are so worthy of our respect and admiration because they said, you know, this new idea really is good. I will embrace it, and I'll go for it, and I will lead with it. And that is so unusual in any business, let alone education, that these folks that I interviewed who've done it are worthy of real thanks from us.
All right, Harold, I can understand why people within education would want to read the book and take note. why would people outside of the education industry, as it were, why should they read the book? Why should they be interested in reading the book? For instance, parents.
Ultimately, these are all public institutions. Parents are the owners. Parents vote. Parents are ultimately called upon to make all of these decisions. When the union, as it is in Chicago today, is threatening to strike, there is a dispute if parents don't understand what both sides stand for and why one side may be right and one side may be wrong, we're not going to get a good result. I mean, there are real issues here, and if parents don't understand them, they will vote badly. They will vote wrong. They will not push reform. I mean, for example, that we go back to evaluation. Many teachers' unions, and I don't mean to pick on the unions, but they in this case happen to be the opponents of this stuff. Many teachers' unions have fought bitterly against changes in tenure laws, which are founded on changes in how schools evaluate teachers. Most of these laws really push schools to do much more stringent evaluations than they used to. And teachers are saying to parents, saying to the public, help us oppose these laws because they're just ganging up on teachers. There's some of the atmospherics where that may be true, but the fundamental point is that in this world, you need much more stringent evaluation. If parents don't understand that, then they can't participate meaningfully in these conversations. And if the union, in this union opposition in this case, were to carry the day, we would not have more stringent evaluation of teachers just at a time when that is fundamentally important to the whole process.
Once again, the book is called Renewal, Remaking America's Schools for the 21st Century. The author is Harold Qualwasser. Harold, a lot of luck with the book.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed being here.